The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Robin Dreek, author of Sizing People Up, a veteran FBI agent's user manual for behavior prediction. And you are listening to Authors in Quarantine, Getting Cocktails.
Hello and welcome to this hopefully short-lived series that will be airing in addition to the weekly Marketing Book podcast interviews. I'm your host, Douglas Burdett, and my goal during this unusual time is to reconnect you with past guests on the Marketing Book podcast, share some ideas and inspiration, and maybe a much-needed laugh or two. I've interviewed over 200 authors on the show, and my plan is to continue this series until I either run out of authors or quarantine, whichever comes first. A word of warning, the host and guest may very likely be drinking cocktails during these conversations. I mean, come on. They are recorded during the cocktail hour. To find the show notes for each episode with pictures of each guest and links mentioned in their conversation, visit marketingbookcocktails.com. marketingbookcocktails.com. See what I did there? And if you'd like to join the conversation, email a voice recording to me at douglas@salesartillery.com, and I'll try to include it in a future episode. I'd love to hear from you. Otherwise, connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat. Robin Dreek, welcome to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails.
Excellent being back with you, Douglas. It's been not too long, but thanks for the invite. I'm happy to be here and happy to share.
Well, I appreciate you coming back. You're one of the more recent authors. You were episode 274, which aired in April of 2020. And where are you, back at your home in Fredericksburg, Virginia?
Yep, in Fredericksburg still since we last chatted. And not a whole lot has changed except the length of my hair. And I'm actually one of the few people probably losing weight right now. I figured the quarantine's a great opportunity to make sure I'm eating healthy and exercising and all that. So there you go.
Oh, good for you. Yeah, well, my hair is getting longer, and about 6 weeks ago, I stopped shaving just to see what would happen. I've never gone this long without shaving. Perhaps it was all that military training I had.
I'll tell you, it's a real challenge. So there's a couple years before I retired from the FBI that I was doing something that I needed to kind of shift my look up a little bit. So I actually let a beard go, and I had it going for about eight or nine months. And there's actually a few shots of me doing a couple of other podcasts with it. And it's funny. It definitely changes your look. Mine is salt and pepper, but mostly gray. And what was really funny is at the same time, my son decided he wanted to get his motorcycle license. And the only way my wife would allow that to happen is if him and I took a motorcycle training class together for 3 days. And our instructor was an old time biker, and he had a big Harley and all that. And I had this half helmet on, so it was just literally covering my skull, and I had the beard, I had the sunglasses, and he gave me the best compliment I ever had in my life so far, because I'm a big fan of Walking Dead, and the guy said I look like Negan, the bad guy in Walking Dead. So I was like, wow, that beard really changed my look up a lot.
Oh, okay. So did you end up getting a license?
I've had mine since 16, so we just did it together. So yes, he got his license too.
And you, do you all have motorcycles?
Yes, I have a Honda Nighthawk Aero, it's a Honda Aero, so it's an 80, what year is that? It was 2006. It's a used one. It's maroon and black. It's gorgeous. It's only a 750, but it's a nice bike. I get to ride it. I got a size that he could actually ride, but since he's at the Naval Academy now, he's not allowed to ride till he graduates. So instead, he's got a nice 1992 Camaro instead that we've worked on. So he's having fun with that.
That's right. And you mentioned that Camaro when you were on, I interviewed you about sizing people up. And you say he's a midshipman at the Naval Academy, but even they sent him home.
Yeah, they've been in lockout, I should say, since the first week of March is when they left on spring break, and he's been home studying the entire time. They're relentless on them. They're still doing number grades, and he is a mechanical engineering major, and he is in the middle of finals right now. And their plan, so all summer training for the Navy, Naval Academy has been canceled. They're looking to put them through more summer school classes. So they're going to just rack their brains all summer long. The incoming plebe class is still going to be indoctrinated. And they're slowly bringing the seniors that are graduating back in waves, since they can't do a big graduation at the stadium this year. What they're doing is they're graduating them in the main T court, it's called, right front of Bancroft Hall, where they first took their oath of office when they came in smaller groups over a course of a couple weeks, so they at least get some of that. So it's different times, no doubt. Everyone's adjusted.
Well, did they also send your son home because you're an alumnus of the Naval Academy and they knew that you'd be able to supervise him and supplement the experience?
No, but I'll tell you, living a little bit closer is definitely a little bit easier, because we feel really bad. He had one of his roommates that live in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he had gone seen a friend on spring break, and it took him forever to get permission because they gave him an all shelter in place order. And so everyone, wherever they were at the end of spring break, had to stay there. And so you had midshipmen all over the country that were just on vacation visiting people that had to get special permission from, you know, the superintendent, the Naval Academy, to actually move and go home. So it was luckily, Kevin was here because we live pretty close.
Oh, wow. That's really something. Well, has your life changed by suddenly you couldn't go back on the road and do training and keynotes?
Yes-ish, kind of. I think what everyone's been doing, at least for the people that I've been talking to, my friends and people in a similar line of work, is the things that I had on the back burner, not because of they weren't as important, just because of time. Because when you travel and you're a keynote speaker and an author, you're on the road a lot. And so you don't have a whole lot of time to work on the other things you want to, which is actually what I've been doing. I've been able to really focus on my online training courses, and I'm really pleased with how they're coming out. A lot of in-depth knowledge, and I got two more I'm working on. So I've been doing that and working on, you know, what you're really great at is, you know, marketing, you know, trying to figure out a whole new paradigm of how to do that. And I've done I've been busier now since this all happened, you know, just because, you know, people are getting really accustomed to doing Zoom calls and doing different, you know, engagements, you know, from their homes. I actually just did a phone call with a group I'm giving a speech to in a couple of weeks, you know, doing a webinar for them. And, you know, she's talking to me. It's the first time I'm meeting her, you know, in person, you know, virtually. Mm-hmm. You know, she's talking to me from her living room. I'm at my home office, which is basically my dining room, you know, and the level of intimacy that people are actually having, even though we're separated by space, is actually a lot higher.
Yeah.
You know, there's one of these relationship accelerators I talk about, which is intensity. And intensity is basically how personal things get, you know, in dialogue and relationships, rather than just, hey, let's talk about the weather over a beer at a bar. These are actually much more intimate because we're all in each other's homes and we never have been before. So it's a really different way of engaging. I think, you know, if you look at the positive out of anything, you can really take a lot from it, I think.
That's true. So you were a Naval Academy graduate, and then you were a Marine Corps officer for 5 years, and then you were with the FBI for 20 years, I believe. Is that right?
21, yes.
21.
I changed myself that extra one.
Okay. That all counts. It all counts. So for those that haven't listened to your interview, remind us what you did in the FBI and then what your most recent book is about.
Sure. So after the Naval Academy, Marine Corps, I came in the FBI in 1997, and I was immediately assigned to the New York field office. So I worked in Manhattan for the first 9 years of my career. And my job inside the FBI the entire time, all 21 years, was I was a counterintelligence agent. And so what that, you know, as a special agent with a specialty in counterintelligence, and what that meant was, especially in New York, my job was to recruit spies. And so I never really considered myself an investigator, because investigators solve crimes, and my job was to recruit spies. So I considered myself an operator.
So it was a sales job, basically.
Yeah, and that's why I always related to it. You know, it's the toughest sales job in the world, right, to me. I'm selling a concept of helping America or American patriotism to foreign spies that are actually diplomats for other countries. You know, so they generally don't want to buy my product, and it was actually by treaty illegal for me to approach them as an FBI agent to try to sell my product to them. So you have a lot of things going against you there.
Mm.
And I eventually took over, you know, I got on a behavioral analysis program, which is layman's terms, it's profiling for counterintelligence, but it's really not profiling. It's actually you're a behaviorist. And so I was a counterintelligence behaviorist on my team, and I took over our behavioral analysis program for counterintelligence in 2010-ish, and ran it for a couple of years. Went back to the field for 4 or 5 years and did cases again at the field level till I retired. So yeah, I've been chatting with people and protecting national security for a very long time.
Well, thanks for doing that. So you, while you were at the FBI, you then codified what's outlined in Sizing People Up about the ability to determine if you could trust someone.
Is that sure. Right? Yeah. So Sizing People Up, it's a progression from, because life is not a destination that you're trying to get to. It's a progression of constantly moving, constantly changing, learning, and bettering yourself so you can be better for others. And so my first book was about building rapport. My second book, The Code of Trust, was about how your behaviors inspire trust in others. And when I started focusing on figuring out how I can inspire someone to trust me, again, anti-manipulation, anti-deception, I am 100% about honest, genuine, sincere, great relationships. I started realizing that you could actually predict what people are going to do. And some people, like in trusting someone, is based on whether you like them or not. And that's a really kind of messy, subjective thing. So I actually talk about trust in terms of predictability.
Right. Okay.
And so that's what this book's about. You know, 6 signs of really reasonably predicting what someone's going to do. And so for the whole purpose of, is this a good, healthy relationship for me? Is it a good, healthy relationship for them? Can we, you know, merge our priorities together and be resources for each other? And so that's what this one was all about.
Yes. And I hope another book that you write about is called Stempathy. I've already put that idea in your head. Explain what Stempathy is. I loved it.
So Stempathy is something I came up with right around the time I was writing this and contemplating, because I was contemplating the fact that there's a chapter in the book that I start out with, you know, how to think like an FBI agent, because it came out because the guy I write with, Cam, he wrote, I remember, you know, you interview, you work on the content, you know, you edit back and forth. And he had come up with this line and he said, I was sweating bullets. And I just looked at him. Well, I looked at him virtually because, you know, we don't do this in person. And I said, Cam, I said, that is like such an inaccurate phrase when referring to me. And what I do is I don't sweat bullets. I think, and he goes, what do you mean? He said, you know, this is a really stressful situation. I said, yeah, but if you get stressed and emotionally hijacked, you can't think. And he said, so you think like an FBI agent? I said, well, I never really thought about it that way, but yes. And so what it is Stempathy is a combination of stoicism and empathy. And stoicism is what I was just talking about. So the Stoics, they're pessimists or no, it's cognitive thought, like just cause and effect of behavior. So if you understand that human beings, we're genetically and biologically coded to want to always act in our own best interest in terms of safety, security, and prosperity for ourselves and our loved ones, you now know what they're going to do. And that's a very cognitive thought process, as long as you understand what that means from their point of view. So that's the stoicism part, which is about understanding cause and effect of behaviors. But at the same time, though, in order to make that great human connection, to build trust, to build relationships, you need to have a massive amount of empathy. In other words, how the other person sees the world from their particular optic, their context, their generation, their ethnicity, their gender, their age, all these things play into that. And to understand another human being is to make that connection, which is grand empathy. So when you put the two together, so you have cognitive thought with empathy, I came up with Stempathy.
There you go. Well, it's I was actually doing an episode of the B2B Growth Show that I do every month with an author named James Muir, and he listens to every episode of the Marketing Book podcast, and then he reads all the books. And so just today, we were recapping the last 4, and he really enjoyed the book, as did I, and we were talking about Stempathy and emotional hijacking, and what a useful book. So,
thank you so much.
Yeah. And I think it's really helpful for, I mean, lots of folks, but particularly, salespeople. And the one thing that James was talking about, just to give you another impression, is he talked about how much empathy you show in the book, meaning just acceptance of people. And that certainly came through when I was reading it, because when you're dealing with these folks, I think a lot of people would think, oh, I want them to change, or I want them to be this way, or they're a bad person, or whether it's like, no, that's actually not helpful.
You know, that is, you know, Douglas, I've done so many of these things, and every once in a blue moon, something someone says just strikes me at my core, and you just did. I mean, I'm sitting here listening to you, you know, sharing what you took away and what he took away about, you know, this feeling I have towards others. And I literally am misty in the eyes and I got goosebumps because you get it. You get what I was about when I wrote the book. It's about understanding others at a deep level and never trying to change anyone, just understanding. And it is such an effort for some people to do that. And most of all, it was an effort for me. I was born and hardwired as a hardcore, hard-charging type A from the Northeast as an extrovert. And I was one very, very hugely judgmental human being. And
then you went in the Marine Corps. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Well, which made it even worse. Right. You know, and so.
Don't get me wrong. I love my Marines.
You know, it's funny. The Marine Corps was a fascinating and great, great life-enhancing experience because it's about being a hard-charging, take-charge type A. But in order to do that, you have to understand your people at a deep core level. Matter of fact, one of the courses I have called A Code of Trust, the thing I have in there, the greatest tool that you'll walk away from it, and that I still use every day, is what I call the leadership notebook. And that's what I did in the Marine Corps. And inside this leadership notebook, you start writing down and understand the priorities and goals of others. You start to understand their context so you can actually communicate effectively. And then you start thinking in terms of how can I be a resource for these people's success in terms of their priorities. That's what I had to do in the Marine Corps. My job was to make sure that my staff NCOs didn't do something stupid to end their careers, at the same time accomplish the mission, and so I can also be a resource where they can be successful in their careers and go home safe at the end of every day. Yeah. So basically, I was a morale officer.
So before a big weekend, you would probably have to do safety briefings. Did the subject of crayons ever come up?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, we got to let people in on the joke. What explain that? What's the deal with Marines and crayons that everyone's always talking about?
Well, it's there's lots of jokes circling around the Marine Corps. You know, crayons, or you have to do a lot of, you know, professional military education, and so we called it math for Marines. You know, where you learn how to add 1 + 1, right, with crayons instead of usually you got to start out with a pencil, you know, because you have to be able to erase things. You move up there from there to crayons, and then from there maybe a pen one day. Or actually, don't call them pens; they call them ink sticks. Marines are very literal; they're ink sticks instead of tennis shoes or sneakers. Are called go fasters.
And it's not a hat, it's a cover.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely not a hat. No, there's funny. Matter of fact, I'm on a Facebook page with all my classmates from the Naval Academy, and we're well beyond our graduation year. We're a pretty tight group. Matter of fact, one of our classmates is the commander, the captain of the Teddy Roosevelt. You know, if you've been following the news at all, that was one of my classmates.
Okay. Now I'm making noise about he should actually
reinstate.
Yeah,
it's fascinating to see how close
you all
are. Maybe
we should explain for folks that don't know that Teddy Roosevelt was deployed in the Pacific. Some of the sailors were getting coronavirus, and he sent a message, I guess, to his chain of command, and it got out what the situation was.
Yeah, they were. His crew was getting sick, and he sent a message up the chain of command to he wanted to pull into Guam to offload the sick people and quarantine so they could. I'm really simplifying it, and that letter got out to the press, and so it caused a big hoopla, and so he was relieved. But now the acting secretary of the Navy, who was also a Naval Academy grad, was fired for some of the actions he took. Oh, actually, not fired. He was turned in his resignation. So now the chain of command is looking at reinstating him. In other words, just a really big, challenging situation. But regardless, the guy is my classmate, and it's really heartening because, you know, when you spend a lot of suffering years together, how it really bonds people. And my class really rallied around him, regardless of anything. And it was nice seeing him supported.
Yeah.
Well, and he also came down with coronavirus too. I don't know his current status, but he actually got infected as well.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, on a normal time, that would be an enormous story, but it's like the coronavirus news is sucking all the oxygen out of the news cycle.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've been talking a lot about this too, recently, you know, because people ask, you know, how is it affecting you? What's going on? And, you know, I start out, you know, my opening story in Sizing People Up is my experiences during 9/11 in New York City, and where I first, you know, where I really started having to put into some sort of effect of who can I trust and who can I inspire to rally behind me so I can move forward with things that were important for national security. And one thing, you know, that this current pandemic reminds me about 9/11 is that anytime something so massively impacts the entire world, such as 9/11, the thing that causes it rarely happens twice, if ever, in history. In other words, you know, the things that happened during 9/11 with the hijacking of those planes and they're flown into buildings, the things that we as a society put into place so that that would never happen again, really pretty much ensured it would never happen that way again. Because, you know, it was such a thing out of the blue, non-predictable, all these things. And so, you know, between air marshals and reinforcing doors and screening people and what you bring on plane, I mean, so many things were put into place to make sure it never happens that way again. I think we're starting to see the signs of that during coronavirus is the same things happening. You know, between great inspirational people that are doing amazing research so fast, so furious, coming up with, you know, things that lessen the impact on people if they do have it, coming up with vaccines, you know, people being so much more aware of social distancing, washing. I mean, all these things that we as a society are doing very rapidly to counter this. I think what will happen is it will never, in our lifetime, my prediction is nothing this severe in the way of a pandemic will happen again for quite some time, just because we saw the horror of it once. And once you see that kind of level of horror, society does amazing things to make sure it doesn't happen that same way again.
That is really interesting. And it does remind me of after 9/11, I was at a party and I was talking to this fellow who was a pilot for a big airline. And you know, we were talking about 9/11 and, you know, how they're securing the cockpit door and some other things. And he just laughed and said, "I'm not worried about it. It's never going to happen again like that."
Yep. So, well, think about this too. I mean, so here we are. I mean, think about the change of how we all think today as compared to a month ago. So about a month ago, I was getting a haircut. I thought nothing of it. You know, I heard about, you know, this thing from Wuhan, you know, that may or may not come here. It wasn't a big deal. And all of a sudden, a month later, if another, you know, I live in an area in Virginia, you know, like you do, you're south of me, that, you know, we haven't been too impacted, but, you know, we still haven't, you know, talked about maybe going to, you know, stage one of opening. But if all of a sudden I read in the paper or saw on the news tomorrow morning that we had an outbreak here, there's no more guessing what to do. I know exactly what to do. I'm going to make sure I have enough toilet paper. I'm going to make sure we have enough food. I'm going to make sure I'm wearing my mask. I know social distancing. You know, I got my sanitizer in the car. I got my wipes. I mean, there's no guessing anymore about what to do to make sure that we don't cause another bloom. We all know exactly what to do. There's, you know, no one has to tell us because we've been exposed to the stress of it. We've been exposed to the horror of it. We've all seen how horrendous it's been in the bigger cities, and we know exactly what to do as a society and individuals never to let that happen again the same way. So that's what I think has really changed.
Interesting. Well, Robin, I got a message from a listener, Maureen Farmer in Nova Scotia, and she was so impressed with the interview that you did on the show in April. And she has called in with this message, and I'd like to play the message now for the listeners to hear, and then ask you to respond. And I would also like you to include that what she's asking in this message is wasn't exactly your area of expertise in the FBI. So you want to make that real clear there.
Absolutely, and I will. And I've really focused on this hard since you shared it with me too. So I'm looking forward to sharing.
Okay, and so and also anyone who wants to send a message to the podcast, just record a voice memo and email it to Douglas@salesartillery.com.
Hello, Douglas. This is Maureen Farmer, and I live in Halifax, Nova Scotia. We interacted a couple of times on LinkedIn a while back, and I listened to your podcast, as I do every week, with Robin Dreek. And I have to tell you, I am absolutely so fascinated by it that I'm going to get his book. And after COVID-19 is over, I'm going to go look for him and see where I can hear him speak in person. I also wanted to let you know that his book is particularly relevant for us right now in Nova Scotia. We just had a mass shooting of 22 people in three different communities in our province, and 22 people died. It was horrific. It happened last weekend, April 18th, 19th, and it would be fascinating to have someone like Robin profile this guy, although it's not going to bring those people back. But look, I just wanted to tell you how much I enjoy your program. I never miss it. And I appreciate your podcasts so much, and just your commitment to your listeners and to your profession. So that's it. This is, again, Maureen Farmer. I'm on LinkedIn, and I hope that I get to maybe meet you someday. Anyway, thank you.
So, Robin, what are your thoughts?
Well, as you said before we listened to it, yes, this is not my area of expertise, in the sense that I am not a profiler and I did not work criminal investigations, you know, which is generally dealing with abnormal psychology. But I am definitely a behaviorist, a human behaviorist, and when I listened to her great question, very, very emotional about what they went up through in Nova Scotia, I really went through basically all I could find, because I'm not privy to any investigation or anything else. I went to all the news articles that actually came out right that day and after that day. And what really struck me, you know, was the same kind of stuff that all my friends, because I am friends with a lot of people on the behavioral analysis unit side, which are the criminal profilers. And we've actually had, you know, on my side as well, when you're dealing with espionage, you know, that is generally dealing with abnormal psych as well. So we dabble in it. But the first thing that struck me was that one of the investigators up there said that this individual seized on trust. And that really struck me, because, you know, he posed as a law enforcement officer, and he rigged his car up to look like a law enforcement car so that people would trust him, which actually fit a profile of what these types of mass shootings generally do. And that is, these people that have, in the United States at least, that have, you know, where have you seen them shoot people up? Schools, theaters, places that have been designated no gun zones, churches, synagogues. It's all the places that are soft targets. And what this individual, again, I am not the professional in this, I don't have all the information, but what he attempted to do, and looks, and he did very successfully, was he created soft targets by seizing on trust by his apparel and his demeanor. And I remember when I was first reading, the first reactions was that they said, you know, we don't know what the motives are. You know, it seems like he just had an argument with his girlfriend. And before that, the last thing he'd been, you know, encounter with the police, I think, goes back to 2001 or something. And what struck me with that was, you know, as a behaviorist, is that people generally don't go from zero to 100 on a scale in a snap of a finger. And if they do, it's generally an emotional hijacking moment where it's it's a crime of passion. And crimes of passion don't last 13 hours. So that's what also struck me with this, was they said it was spurred, you know, potentially spurred by an argument he had with his girlfriend or his domestic partner. And I'm like, and the thing that struck me with that one is, like, that would be a crime of passion, which doesn't last that long. And also, this is premeditated. You don't have someone that's able to impersonate a law enforcement officer and have a car that looks like a law enforcement car as a moment of passionate, you know, response, you know, over response. And so that's what kind of struck me as a little incongruent at the beginning of that. And then as I looked, you know, a couple of weeks later at what they're saying, was that this had been, he had actually had a number of disputes with people, and they've been escalating over time. And so that started making a little bit more sense to me as I was reading it. Again, open source is all I saw. And so I think one of the things that Maureen was, you know, kind of searching for is, you know, how do you, and like we all do, you know, like, how do you recognize this? How do you prevent this from happening? That's a tough question. It always is tough, because here's what's really tough. What's really tough is human beings in general that act and live within the normal parameters of human behavior. We're very forgiving and we're very trusting, and we don't want to believe the worst in people. And we're also very leery of pointing fingers at people and accusing people of being a certain way, because again, that can have a backlash on us, in whether it's professionally or personally. And so, but in general, when people are escalating, in other words, what's happening is people like this, they're starting to show deviations in their normal behavior. And so as you start observing and people in his life are seeing deviations in normal behavior, you know, that's when you have to take notice and say, what's going on here? Is this a threat? Do I tolerate it? Do I turn my head and look the other way, or don't I? You know, I can, in hindsight, it's always 20/20 with these things. And it's the same thing, whether it's espionage and internal threats to places. Hindsight, in every single case, is said, and you've always then been able to find people that said, I did, something was a little off. Something was a little different. This request they made for this was a little different. Why would he be asking that? You know, so when you piece all these things together, you know, hindsight gives us that 20/20. Unfortunately, though, it's hard to put those pieces together, because we are a very forgiving society.
His girlfriend was probably too close to the situation.
It's very hard to see changes when you're that close, because you're emotionally attached to the outcome. And so they have, you know, people that are that close definitely have a bias. They, in other words, they have the empathy part without the stoicism part of the cause and effect.
Any thoughts on, you know, on the grief process that the people in Nova Scotia are going through? Because I mean, you know, when I've heard people talk about how grief is actually something that a lot of people are going through right now, even not even the people that endured that in Nova Scotia, but the grief of all this change and what's suddenly been thrust upon us.
Yeah, I have faced it as well. You know, the matter of fact, I've been putting together my online training and expanding my current, you know, presentation for sizing people up. And I really do a deeper dive on 9/11 and 9/11 as the impact it had on me as an individual.
We should remind listeners that you were there in Lower Manhattan when it happened.
Yeah. I was about five blocks away when the North Tower got hit by the plane. I had counted about eight bodies jumping from the North Tower before the second tower, but before the South Tower got hit. You know, I was in the middle of a lot of mayhem. And every day when you went home and when you came back down to the city, going through multiple checkpoints, and there's all these kids and mothers and fathers, you know, standing on street corners, holding up signs, please find my father, please find my son. I mean, it was the most heart-wrenching thing in the entire world. And you felt the entire world was counting on you to try to save it. And it really puts you into a tailspin of thinking you're not doing enough. And then you have the grief of it. Then you have survivor's guilt, you know, if people go through that. And the thing that was the most effective thing for me, by accident, not by design, because, you know, type A's are macho guys that, you know, don't accept help, because especially when you're in a place where no one's really offering it anyway, was...
Well, and let's be honest, it is a sign of weakness, Robin. Come on.
Yeah. Not anymore. Matter of fact, I get really angry at I know a lot of, you know, matter of fact, I have a friend who's a law enforcement officer locally that I remember when they told me about, you know, only a couple of months ago, you know, they actually were the first situation where someone lost a life. And the first thing I said to them was, who are you talking to? You have to talk to someone now, because this will, I mean, it can eat you up. Mm-hmm. And that's what luckily for me, that's what I had. You know, not only did I have a great supportive wife that, you know, that just listened or didn't listen, whatever I needed. But the really important thing was, you know, in my book, I have this mentor and guide called Jesse Thorne. He's a real life guy. Matter of fact, he emailed me yesterday. I chatted with him nonstop. In other words, I had a good, healthy relationship. And so I'd recommend for everyone going through, you know, whether you're emotionally and spiritually stressed right now because of COVID-19 and everything that's going on with that, whether you're losing a job, lost a job, don't have enough money, you're socially isolated, all these things. And then for the people in Nova Scotia, same thing. You know, there's no magic bullet that can fix this. I don't understand the stages of recovery because they're, I mean, I know them, but I really think that if nothing else, the first thing you need to do is share, talk, share to someone who's not judging you and not trying to fix you, just listening to you. Listening and validating are the such key important things. Matter of fact, those four things I talk about all the time that human beings seek and crave, it is so much more important now to utilize these things with everyone you're talking to all the time, because we need to feel connected. We need to feel understood. And this is it. You seek the thoughts and opinions of others, or you find someone that you can share yours with without being judged. Second, you talk in terms of your priorities if you need to share. And if you want to give it the gift to someone else, talk in terms of their priorities, their needs, wants, dreams, and aspirations. In other words, things that make them feel safe and secure, and things that will make them feel prosperous. Finally, the third thing is validate them. In other words, don't judge them. Don't seek to fix them. Validation means seek to understand them. Have a deep-seated curiosity about understanding what they're going through, understanding how they feel, understanding the challenges that they think they have. You know, and so validation goes a long way to healing. And then finally, if appropriate, empower people with choices. Because what happens is once you understand and listen to someone's goals and priorities, you know, the only way you can help people move forward is by asking them discovery questions, which are choices. You know, say, hey, you told me you're trying to get through this. Help me understand, is what you're doing here helping or hindering you moving forward? And maybe you don't feel like moving forward yet. That's fine too. So again, you're talking in terms of their priorities, you're seeking their thoughts and opinions, you just gave them choices. So I think the first step to help people move forward and heal is just to be able to do that to each other and for each other.
Yes. And I think you had mentioned you'd been doing some work with American military veterans dealing with PTSD. Is that right?
Yeah. It's I work with a lot of different groups from time to time. I was fortunate enough to, there's a group of folks that I've chatted with numerous times. And yeah, it's, man, it's, everyone's dealing with something. That's all I can say. You know, whether you've seen horrific, I can't even relate to some of the stuff our warfighters have seen today. I was in the Marine Corps at a time when we weren't doing what we're doing today. That's for sure. And so everyone's dealing with something. So yeah. You just got to be there. And you, it's not just being there. It's understanding how to communicate in terms of them and stop the keeping the focus on yourself. And people aren't doing it intentionally, but the words we're using that can be very self-centered, it's not going to help anyone else. So include those four things when you're chatting with someone, and that makes sure it's about them and their brain. It's a healthy thing for their brain to hear. It's healthy for them to share their thoughts and opinions. It's healthy for others to talk in terms of their priorities. It's very healthy for others to be validated, and if appropriate and timely, give them choices for how you can be a resource for them.
Is one of the bigger problems with validation and not doing it right when somebody's listening and they want to help, and they're trying to solve the problem or give the answer to what they need to go do?
Yeah, that's a challenge, because I'd say 9 times out of 10, people are not looking for you to fix it. They just want to be heard for it. Mm-hmm. I deal with this with my son all the time, you know, or anyone, you know. I mean, as parents, mentors, teachers, and guides, whether you're you know, superior to someone at work by title, or whether, you know, you're a spouse or a parent, you know, when you hear someone that you have great empathy for and you hear them in pain or distress, the first impulse we have is to try to fix it for them, especially if we have experience and especially if we know what we think will work or would work for us. We want to fix it. And well, only fix it or try to fix it if that's what they want. Because again, most of the time, they're just looking to be heard. You know, I use this this kind of phraseology all the time. That is, you know, I tend not to teach, mentor, or guide anyone. I never give people how to do this or how to fix this. If I listen to what their priorities are, because I'm now objective, because we'll talk about that stoic side, where if I understand your goals and objectives, I see your skill sets, I then can ask what I call discovery questions of you. In other words, if I hear, all right, you're trying to get to point B and you're at point A, and you're kind of running around in circles, emotionally hijacked, and you're stressed, you have frustration, anger, and I just simply ask you, instead of telling you, hey, if you just shut up and go from here to there, you're going to make it. They don't want to hear that. People are more likely to take action question if they discovered on their own. That's why I call them discovery questions. So instead of saying, here's what you need to do, all I say is, I say, hey, help me understand. You're doing X, Y, and Z. Is any of these things helping you, or are they hindering you from getting to where you're trying to go? And all you're doing is you starting to have them engage your cognitive brain, and then they will come up with their answer about whether it's working or not. And then they say, huh, I don't know. I don't think it's working. I said, well, what kind of things are you considering that might actually be helpful for you get from there? You know, what's the resume of someone that's doing that position? What kind of things you need to do along the way, do you think? Again, you're just constantly asking questions so people will discover their path when they're ready to discover it.
You know, Robin Drake, I'm a slow learner, and I read your book and you use the term discovery questions, and I'm afraid I confused it with the sales term of a discovery call. But just now, I finally put two and two together and understood why you call it a discovery call, because you're helping them discover.
Right. They're discovering their path, not me discovering. Yeah, it's granted, the entire time you're listening, you're discovering their path with them, but it's really for them to discover the route that they're meant to take. And the way that you're, again, I have the three anchors that for everything I do is the most important things is I make sure that everything I do supports a good, healthy professional relationship, open, honest communication, and transparency. Because if you have that, you're on the road to that healthy relationship. And then the third is I'm an available resource for the success and prosperity of others without expectation or reciprocity. And so this as that third anchor there, you know, an available resource for others. And how are your resource for others? Well, you have to understand what's important for others. You have to understand their priorities. And when you understand their priorities and now you're objective, because I'm not emotionally attached to their decisions, then I can ask those discovery questions. And that's what is really, that is how you really, that's what great, great inspirational leaders do. They're a resource for others. And how are your resource? You bring resources to bear for them. And how do you do that? You help them discover the path they're meant to walk to where they're trying to go.
Amen. Well, one last question I just have to ask. I'm sorry, but I've had a drink now and
it's Friday.
Yeah. So you were dealing with all these Russians, okay? So did guys like Vladimir Putin hate you, or were there Russians that were, you know, maybe trying to diminish you or get rid of you? Because it seems like you must have been an awful thorn in their side.
that's such a funny question. they definitely,
well, you'd tell me, but then you'd have to kill me. I know.
No, it's actually pretty funny. I was pretty aggressive, at the first couple years of my career. And I was so aggressive that I really just became a nuisance. That was just discarded. I did a lot of undercover work. And after a little bit of time, I think they were really on to me, and I just became this nuisance in their lives. That this Tasmanian devil of an FBI intelligence officer that was trying to recruit them, that they just didn't want to spend any of their time with.
They just gave up on you, I guess.
It was just. I literally threw everything I possibly could at every operation I was doing, just trying to win. And you know, in hindsight, I was relentless. It's just, so to say that one of them, just like I didn't hate any of these people. They were just decent human beings that had a different context of how the world was supposed to operate. And what were they all doing? They're all acting in their own best interest in terms of safety and security, prosperity for themselves and their families and their loved ones. Their sense of understanding of what prosperity was is different than mine. And so that's where non-judgmental validation comes in. And it's like, I understood exactly how they saw that. I didn't say I approved of it. I said I understood it, because validation is understanding. And so I didn't hate anyone. And I know they didn't hate me. I know it was kind of a pain in their butt. That's about it.
But you don't go on vacations to Russia.
No. although it's really funny. All my books are in print in Russia and in China.
Oh, really?
So it's kind of a hoot. Matter of fact, the code that actually sizing people up, it's in a bunch of different languages. And believe it or not, the folks that have been doing the most publicity for it is in Poland. And I have done so much publicity work for Poland, And I asked one of the people, one of the interviewers a couple of days ago, I said, wow, you guys have been really fantastic. I said, how come you guys are really high on my book over there? And they said, well, you know, this book's all about trust and we don't trust anyone over here. I was like, oh, okay.
Well, they probably also like sticking a finger in Russ's eye too. So
that too, that helps. So yeah, I'm sorry, I'm chuckling so much. I'm just thinking about, it was a funny question you asked. I've never been asked that before about whether they hated me or not hated me. And I just really thought hindsight of my first 10 years of my career. And I did a lot of things and all of them were really probably very bothersome to them.
Well, that tingling means it's working. So you were probably doing the right thing.
You know, I said during the last podcast with you, you know, I called it, you know, hitting lotto, you know, because it's so rare to get someone on board that decides they want to buy my product of American patriotism, but it's so beneficial because you understand everything they're trying to do. You understand all their sources, their methods, their targeting. You know, it's like hitting lotto because it's that rare and that beneficial. And so I was relentlessly trying to buy a lotto ticket every single day, meaning I had so many different operations I was trying to do. And here's the great thing. None of them were mean-spirited. None of them were coercive. It's, you know, so how do you recruit a Russian spy? Easy. You don't. You just figure out what their priorities are and you offer resources. And my job is to figure out which one of them had priorities that they actually didn't want their children to grow up over there, but they'd rather have them grow up over here. That's pretty basic because, again, according to them, the ones that did have that, their priorities was that their children would grow up in a place that had, you know, opportunities for more prosperity for their futures, better healthcare, better education, whatever it was, or dying wish of a mother or a grandfather was that their grandchildren wouldn't grow up over there. My job is just to figure out which ones might have had that and let them know I have what they need. that was pretty much that simple.
And that's why everybody in sales should read Sizing People Up, because there were so many lessons in there. So, well, Robin Drake, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you again, and I appreciate you coming back on Authors in Quarantine, getting cocktails, and I hope that you and your family continues to stay safe and healthy and reasonably sane.
You too, Douglas, and to all listeners too. Stay healthy, stay sane, stay safe, and thank you so much for having me back on. Love chatting with you. You're a great host, and I appreciate you much.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. With every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number and taken away your name.